You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 29th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, an interviewer with Nick Hanauer. He is the Seattle-based entrepreneur, author of Gardens of Democracy, whose TED Talk was not posted until there was an outcry and then subsequently posted. That TED Talk on debunking the myth that entrepreneurs and business people are job creators. We will get to that interview shortly. Spoke to him last week. It's pre-record, but just as fresh as the moment I recorded it. Also on the program today, Fukushima still in hot water. Forget the pun. News Corp still in hot water. No pun intended. BP, did they lie? My guess would be yes. A massive piece in the New York Times about our policy of killing people via drones and how we classify those people. We will talk briefly about that. And it seems, oddly enough, that all of those embedded regulators at JP Morgan were embedded in divisions of the company, but for the one that lost billions of dollars. None of that should come as a surprise. I didn't watch much TV this weekend, and I had missed both episodes of Up With Chris, my favorite program on television, news program. And generally, as you know, I watch it generally I watch it on the internet. And after the fact, they post most of the show. And so I was checking my email. I sign up to a lot of right-wing crazies' email lists. And I saw this from Newsbusters. Or I guess this actually came from Tea Party .com. And via teaparty.com, they had posted a Newsbusters thing. And little did I know, I see these things that are, this is an outlier. These people aren't so ridiculous as to make a story out of this, but apparently they were successful. So Chris Hayes on Sunday, talking about Memorial Day, had just finished a segment in the segment prior, with an interview of a soldier killed in the so-called War on Terror. He talked about a speech that Joe Biden gave. He interviewed a casualty assistance officer whose job it is to tell parents that, or I guess wives and children, that they've lost a loved one. Since 9/11, in our various wars, we have lost little over 6,000 U.S. military personnel. The numbers of injured in the tens of thousands, 30, 40,000, probably more, depending on whose numbers you use. So Chris Hayes came back from break, and this is the segment. This is how he started the segment.
Lots of thinking today and observing Memorial Day that'll be happening tomorrow. I just talked with Lieutenant Colonel Steve Burke, who was a casualty officer with the Marines and had to tell people. And I think it's interesting because it is, I think, very difficult to talk about the war dead and the fallen without invoking valor, without invoking the words heroes. Why do I feel so comfortable about the word hero? I feel uncomfortable about the word hero because it seems to me that it is so rhetorically proximate to justifications for more war. And I don't want to obviously desecrate or disrespect the memory of anyone that's fallen. And obviously there are individual circumstances in which there is genuine and tremendous heroism of, you know, hail of gunfire and rescuing fellow soldiers and things like that. But it seems to me that we marshal this word in a way that is problematic. But maybe I'm wrong about that. No.
Okay, so Chris Hayes is basically saying that he has hesitation in using the word hero for every fallen military personnel, because he worries that it glorifies war in and of itself. This is not a particularly new concept or new thought. It may be we never hear anyone on television, on cable news, or any news program for that matter, say anything like that. But when you hear military personnel or vets who describe the reasons why they signed up for the military, so much of it has to do with this notion of I wanted to be a hero. So much of it has to do with the notion of just for how many years in this country, every type of media outlet that talked about war glorified it. And in many respects, still does. And I think this is a fairly thoughtful and measured, certainly, beginning of the segment. I mean, he goes on to say specifically that I don't want to desecrate or disrespect the memory of anyone that's fallen. And then after some discussion, later he says, the argument on the other side is we don't have a draft. This is voluntary. This is someone who's making a decision to take on a certain risk of that. And they're taking it on because they're bound to all of us through this social contract, through this democratic process of self-governance in which we decide collectively that we're going to war. He's making the other argument as to why this word should be used. This is so obviously a benefit, so obviously a gift, the fact that we can have this type of level of discourse on our television, on cable news, is almost shocking in and of itself. And now we see just a tremendous outpouring on the right of anger towards Hayes. But even these morons from Newsbusters say, well, in fairness, Hayes and the other panel members distinguish between their respect for the valor of the individual military members who had given their lives with the worthiness of the various causes in which they fought. I mean, they're just so clearly going after Hayes here because they got nothing. I mean, what really should have happened is we should have seen 50 articles praising Chris Hayes for actually having an adult conversation about these things. And instead, Hayes, I guess, emailed a statement to various media outlets. Mediate is where I saw it. saying on Sunday in discussing the uses of the word hero to describe members of the armed forces who have given their lives, I don't think I lived up to the standards of rigor, respect, and empathy for those affected by the issues we discussed that I've set myself. I am deeply sorry for that. As many have pointed out, it's easy for me, a TV host, to opine about the people who fight our wars, never having dodged a bullet or guarded a post or walked a mile in their boots. One of the points made during Sunday's show was just how removed most Americans are from the wars we fight, how small a percentage of our population is asked to shoulder the entire burden, how easy it becomes to never read the names of those who are wounded and fight and die, to not ask questions about the direction of our strategy in Afghanistan, and to assuage our own collective guilt about this disconnect with pro forma ritual that we observe briefly before returning to our barbecues. But in seeking to discuss the civilian-military divide and the social distance between those who fight and those who don't, I ended up reinforcing it, conforming to a stereotyped of removed pundit whose views are not anchored in the very real and very wrenching experience of this long decade of war, and for that I am truly sorry. Look, I have, you know, no problem with Chris Hayes apologizing if he feels that in some way he was a little flip or glib about these things. But as far as I can tell, it was the most thoughtful and measured conversation about these things that I've ever seen on television. And simply having this conversation, simply raising the idea that we use the word hero as a way of enticing people to fight wars of choice, or wars where they will carry all the burden. Because, of course, nobody... I'm sorry, we've been waging two wars in this country for 10 years. And I would be shocked if even 50% of Americans in this country were conscious of it more than every 6 months. That's the reality. And I can't imagine a more artful or respectful way of raising that concept. So I think it's, I mean, I understand why Hayes apologizes, and I think that's just because he's far more sensitive in general to people than most, which I think allows him to present a story like that. But it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, my interview with Nick Hanauer, recorded just towards the end of last week. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. We are back on the Majority Report. Sam Cedar on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Nick Hanauer. He is an entrepreneur, a venture capitalist living in Seattle, Washington. He is the co-founder of the True Patriot Network, and which is based on ideas that came out of the book that he co-authored, The True Patriot. Thanks for joining us, Nick.
You bet.
So let's start with, and of course, you gave a TED Talk a couple of months ago, I guess it was. And it ultimately generated some controversy. Let's start with what you were talking about in the TED Talk. You were specifically addressing this notion of tax breaks for so-called job creators, and specifically the wealthy. Tell us, sum up that talk for us.
So the talk I gave at TED was based on So my writing partner and I, Eric Liu, have just published another book called The Gardens of Democracy, and the talk I gave at TED is based on essentially some ideas about economics in that book that we call middle-out economics, largely the idea that the argument that the trickle-down notion of economics is just completely and totally false, and that when you understand economies as they truly are, as ecosystemic rather than mechanistic, you instantly see that jobs are a consequence of essentially a circle of life-like feedback loop between businesses and their customers. And if you don't have any customers, you don't have any businesses. And in that sense, middle-class consumers are the true job creators in a capitalist economy. And if they don't thrive, neither do businesses. And so that's the generalized argument. In a world where the middle class doesn't thrive, neither does business. And the stronger and more robust the middle class is, the more robust the business climate will be. And in that sense, middle class consumers are far more job creators than capitalists like me. And of course, the point of all of this is that giving tax breaks and low tax rates and big exemptions to capitalists and rich people, on the theory that they will create jobs, makes no sense if they're not job creators, and that it's a much more reasonable and frankly more economically effective approach to give the tax breaks to the middle class and to more appropriately tax the people at the very tippy top, both individually and I should add corporations too.
And so basically it's demand in the context of this ecosystem that starts the process of creating growth and ultimately creating jobs.
Yeah, well, demand is the thing that can animate a virtuous cycle of increasing prosperity, right? Because the more prosperous the middle class becomes, the more stuff they can buy, which forces people like me to hire more people. When I hire more people, now then again there's more people who want to buy my stuff, which forces me again to hire more people. The more people I hire, the more labor becomes rare, the higher wages I have to pay, and now again people can buy more stuff, and I have to hire more people. This is broadly speaking the story of the post-war period. The median wage was rising, and business was awesome as a consequence of that. Right, so it's a circle of life like feedback loop between customers and businesses that animates prosperity,
This is something Henry Ford was talking about, right?
Right. People have talked about it for a long time, but we have somewhat lost sight of it. Part of the reason we've lost sight of it is that the economic models that we have used for the last 30, 40, 50 years are mechanistic in nature, and they don't they basically don't allow you to see things in terms of these feedback loops. But we know now with scientific certainty that the economy isn't just similar to an ecosystem, it actually is a kind of ecosystem, and as a consequence of that, it's subject to the same kinds of feedback loops. And once you see it as an ecosystem, the craziness of the current sort of economic orthodoxy becomes much clearer, and it becomes much more obvious that a more fruitful path for everybody, middle class, poor, and rich, is to more appropriately tax corporations and rich people so that we have enough money to invest in the middle class. But there's another really insidious part of rising inequality that I think is not well understood, and that is that the more unequal, so it's not just the problem of middle-income consumers not having enough money. because the amount of money in a society you make isn't relevant. The only thing that's relevant is how much you make in relation to other people. And if you have a class of people for whom the price is no object, what that does is it stretches the society apart, because some of us can afford anything. And so all of the things that you need to survive become more expensive, even though you don't have any more money. And so that's what's happened in the middle class, is that wages have been stagnant for 30 years. But in addition, health care, the cost of sending a kid to college, all these costs have exploded and have spiraled out of reach for most Americans.
Because we have a class in this country for which money is simply not an issue.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I can bid up the price of anything. Anything you want to buy, I can outbid you.
Indeed.
Right? And so that puts pricing pressure on everything.
And so let's talk. I want to just talk specifically about that difference between mechanistic and viewing the economy as mechanistic or as an ecosystem.
No.
I have a sense of what you're talking about it as an ecosystem, but tell us what it means to view it as a system that is mechanistic.
So the entire edifice of traditional economics is rooted in some assumptions, many of them born in the 19th century, that the economy is a linear system, it's a closed system, and it's a mechanistic system. So let me give you just one example of that thinking. That is that the entirety of traditional economics rests on the assumption that people, the agents in the system, are perfectly rational, perfectly calculating, and perfectly selfish. Basically every single person has to be able to make these perfect net present value calculations about everything they do in order to make traditional economics work. And of course, we now know, again, with scientific certainty, that that's not what people are like at all. People aren't rational, they're emotional, they're not calculating, they're approximating, and they're not selfish either. They're mostly reciprocal. And when you understand people in that way, all of these traditional economic models break down. Let me give you an example of why this is not just some academic curiosity. So there's a kind of economic model that the government uses to forecast what's going to happen to the economy. It's called a stochastic general equilibrium model. And after the meltdown of 2007-08, they assembled a bunch of people to try and figure out what went wrong. So in this model that models the entire country, guess how many banks were in that model? Well, I won't let you guess. The answer is zero. There were zero banks in the model because, according to the equilibrium theory of economics, the efficient market hypothesis, banks don't matter because they're a perfectly efficient pass-through.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the banks are what created the problem. There are 70 million households in the United States. In the model the government used, there was just one household modeled, a perfectly rational, perfectly selfish, and perfectly calculating household. And so this view of how the world works is just completely wrong, and will lead you into some craziness if you're not careful.
And I'd argue, frankly, that that there are even times where rational self-interest, even if we were all rational self-interested players, we would still ultimately have a problem. Just take, for example, the notion of antibiotics. There is no reason for me as an individual not to take antibiotics every time I have an infection, every time it's even vaguely warranted, if I can afford it. However, ultimately, what we're going to do if everyone chose that path is to create these super strains of bacteria that are going to be problematic for everyone.
What's happened over the last 20 or 30 years, and basically the subject of the book that we just wrote, The Gardens of Democracy, is that there's been a revolution in our understanding of human social systems, not as mechanistic, linear, and closed, but as complex, adaptive, and ecosystemic, and evolutionary, right? As an ecosystem, the economy, for instance, is subject to the same kinds of forces as the evolutionary forces as natural ecosystems. And the issue that you raise is a very good one and is a perfect example of the tension that human societies face as social creatures, the tension between competition within a group for what's best for the individual versus competition of the group with other groups. And there will always be a tension between what's good for me individually in the moment and what's good for the group competing with another group over the long term. And you know, we have a political orthodoxy in this country coming mostly from the right, which is the idea that the only thing that matters is worrying about what's good for the individual and never what's good for the group. And that's where, you know, all this anti-tax stuff comes from. That's where all this anti-regulation stuff comes from. That's where, you know, this sort of libertarian craziness comes from.
How do you reconcile the notion that over the past 30, 40 years, we have a clearer understanding of our economy and our society functioning as an ecosystem, but at the same time, the orthodoxy, the default conventional wisdom has sort of tracked in the other direction?
Because almost no one understands this. So there are tiny outposts in academia that have begun to incorporate this new science into the social sciences. The Institute for New Economic Thinking at Oxford is one of them. But you know, this is the bleeding edge of rethinking how to order society, and it is going to take, I regret to admit, quite a long time for these ideas to sink into people's consciousness. And for certainly the academic world to begin to make the shift, you know, we're at the dawn, frankly, of a new kind of enlightenment, rethinking in almost every way about how human societies work and how we should order them to make things go better. But you know, it's going to be a slog, you know. It's a very important thing to begin to talk about.
Well, let me ask you if you think that part of the reason why that has occurred is at least in some way indicative of what happened with your talk. So you did this talk in I guess it was in April, there's National Journal released some of an email exchange between you and the curator of TED, which is, I think by now most of my audience is aware of what TED is. It's a series of conferences that has grown exponentially in terms of providing these a forum for these things. And at first your talk was received well, it appears.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened after that.
Well, I mean, so, you know, the talk I gave was in turn based on an op-ed that I wrote for Bloomberg Business Week on this very subject, and that op-ed went hyper-viral. The op-ed, at least according to the editors at Bloomberg, was the most read op-ed in their history. So the ideas are very potent and very interesting to people, and the talk that I gave at TED was based on that, and I got a great reaction at the conference, albeit lots and lots of people don't like to hear this message. It's a very tough message for people like me, who are wealthy and entrepreneurs and who have always thought of themselves as essentially the center of the economic universe, right, as job creators. But the TED people loved it, and or at least told me they loved it, and they were going to release it. And then, you know, as things unfolded, they decided in the end that it was too, what they considered to be too political and too controversial. I understand that. It threatens an orthodoxy that a huge number of people have a huge stake in. And when Copernicus came along and made the observation that the Earth was not the center of the solar system, it was the sun, he was not welcomed with open arms by the rich and powerful people in that society, because they had a huge stake in the old orthodoxy, right? They had a stake in people believing that the Earth was the center of the solar system. And there's a huge number of powerful people in this country, rich and powerful people, who very much want to believe that rich business people are the center of the economic universe, that we are job creators. Because if you believe that, then we, people like me, deserve status and privileges. Privileges like the 233% difference in the tax rate between what capitalists pay on capital gains, dividends, and carried interest at 15%, and the 35% top marginal rate that ordinary Americans pay for work, right? You can't justify that giant difference in tax rates unless you deify capitalists like me.
And in fact, you started off your talk by saying this is an article of faith for Republicans and one that is seldom challenged by Democrats.
Yeah, and most Democrats also accept this orthodoxy.
Indeed.
Even President Obama accepts this orthodoxy, in my opinion. I mean, I've never talked to him directly about it, but the best argument that President Obama can make against economic rising inequality is an argument of fairness, right? That it's unfair, or as my 9-year-old daughter loves to say, it's mean. Inequality is mean, and indeed inequality is mean, but that's not the best argument against it. The best argument against it, rising inequality, is a death spiral of falling demand. It's terrible for business.
And we've seen, in fact, it was a Democrat who dropped the capital gains rate down to its levels here. So this
So we have all bought into this economic orthodoxy. You know, made us Democrats feel proud when we say, well, no, it's small businesses that create the jobs. Well, small businesses don't create jobs either. It's their customers that create jobs. The economy creates jobs. A business person claiming to create jobs is like a squirrel claiming to have created evolution, or a lion claiming to have created zebras. It's the other way around, and right? The economy creates jobs. Evolution created squirrels.
And I mentioned that because in responding to the release of this story, the curator of TED accused your piece as being too partisan. And
right.
In fact, the words partisan and Republican come up more in his explanation of why it was at first not posted. Ultimately, it was posted because essentially of the blowback. But
right. I would just like to say, I mean, I think, so here's the thing. It's worth saying that, you know, it's Chris Anderson's conference, and he's an incredibly bright and thoughtful guy, and I happen to know that he cares as much about inequality as I do. So he's been treated pretty unfairly. I think he made an error in judgment not posting my talk, but I do know that he does care about these issues,
All right. Well, I raise this not to demonize Chris Anderson.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think what's actually far more important is that there are mechanisms that prevent someone like Chris Anderson, regardless of what his perspective is on it, and it exemplifies it even more if he agrees with the substance of what you're talking about. And its popularity, I think, is very hard to argue at this point.
Yeah.
And I think what it speaks to is the other forces that are maintaining this as conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
Because if we see it at TED, which is arguably on the margins of distribution mechanisms that should be restricted, and I'm talking as opposed to the corporate media or corporate newspapers, then it just gives us a window into that process of how these ideas are actually subjugated.
Yeah, and for sure, it is a controversial message, right? It's not for a rich business guy like me. It's not a great way to win friends, right? Not super popular.
Well, of course, the irony is that there's plenty of documentation. There's been plenty of books written just in the past 6 months, I think, frankly.
Yeah.
That would make the argument that at the end of the day, the future of those wealthy people and of the corporations is reliant upon this new perspective.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's my fundamental point. Is that I'm not arguing that I want my taxes raised because I'm like some sweetheart do-gooder. I'm just convinced that it's the surest way to provide a great opportunity, but both for other people, but in particular for people like me in the future. The more the middle class thrives, the better business will be for everybody. And the single shrewdest thing I think we can do as a society is to tax rich people like me and profitable corporations more, so that we can afford to invest back in the middle class. And when we do, it will be better for them, it will be better for the poor, and it will be better for the rich. I just think it's a smart way to organize ourselves.
And another irony is that the week that this becomes a story, and we're pre-recording this now, but just this week, at the same time that your talk is being considered controversial, we have Nancy Pelosi coming out and essentially pre-bargaining away and going further than even President Obama. President Obama wants to allow the Bush tax cuts for people making over $250,000 to expire. She comes out today and says $1 million should be the cutoff. And we know that half of the benefits that actually go to the tax cuts that remain will actually accrue to millionaires, because their money from $250,000 to $1 million remains untaxed. And because, of course, we have marginal tax rates. So how do we and you know, from the perspective of myself, who has a completely member supported program, and from the perspective of people who listen to this program, whether it's on radio or on via podcast or whatever it is, when we see a millionaire have trouble at least breaking through in a venue as in many respects as supposedly as less constrained as TED, how do we get this message out there? How do we permeate the broader mainstream narrative?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not a media expert. I wish I had a good answer to that. I do think that this idea, the central idea that, you know, that I sort of point to in the talk and the subject of our book, is a very powerful meme, that if you can get ordinary Americans to stop believing that rich business people are job creators and start believing that they are the job creators, I think you've changed the political and economic landscape. I think that you know getting people to start to reject this orthodoxy that if you pour money into rich people in the form of tax breaks, like an ingredient, jobs and prosperity will squirt out of them like donuts. If there was a shred of truth to the idea that the lower the tax rates on the rich or businesses got, or the more wealth the wealthy got, the more jobs we'd create, today we would be drowning in jobs, given how rich people like me have gotten. I mean, it just cannot be true. And that's because businesses don't hire more people when they have an abundance of profit. They hire more people when they have an abundance of customers. And that's what we've got to get back to.
Nick Hanauer, author with Eric Liu of the Gardens of Democracy and the website TruePatriot.org. Is that correct?
Yeah, or GoDemocracy.org.
GoDemocracy.org. Mm-hmm. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
We are back, and that is the – that, ladies and gentlemen, marks the end of the first half of the show. Now on to the better half. How can you join us there? By becoming a member of the Majority Report. How can you ensure that this show continues? By becoming a member of the Majority Report. How can you get things like free DVD? By becoming a member of the Majority Report. How can you make yourself feel better in those moments where you wake up at 3 a.m. and say, what am I doing with my life? Arguably, by becoming a member of the Majority Report. Not necessarily, but those times
when that happens, you know, anything you can hold on to, you're groggy. Believe me, I know. That's why I became a member of the Majority Report. Just to make myself feel better the next day, that the numbers had been continued to grow. Folks, you can join us in the better half of the program. We'll take your phone calls. We'll take your IMs. The number is 646-257-3920. The IM is Majority FM. In the better half, we'll be talking about some of these banking stories. Oh, just the horrible silence on this. I hesitate to call it a race riot in Israel, but it was really more of like an attack on black emigres in Israel. We'll talk a little bit about this drone strike piece. Look to do so more in the rest of the week. Join us in the better half, won't you? Oh, you can also support this program, of course, by going to justcoffee.coop, getting the new Majority Report branded blend. You can give us a review on iTunes. Even if you're broke, you can help this show. Review us on iTunes, donateyouraccount.com. I think we only have like 400 reviews on iTunes. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's embarrassing. Go, folks. Review the show. See you in the better half.